1. Welcome to the season 1 finale of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Claire Malky. Wow. When Mike and I started the ideas for this show back 1,000 years ago in late January 2020, we thought the biggest story we would cover would be the candidacy of Joe Biden. Little did we know that a global pandemic would erupt right before our eyes. Regardless of timing, working on this show has shifted my mindset in so many ways. Throughout these episodes, it's been my goal to give you the tools to form opinions about hot-button issues and to give you an easy way to stay informed. And to be a respectable host, I had to start living it. I'm beginning to give myself permission to learn about the world around me and to stand my ground. Instead of shying away from those moments of tension, I'm starting to level with them. And it's been so hard sometimes and awkward, and I know I've messed up. And that's the beauty of it. It's called growing. We originally thought this episode would be called How to Debate Rather Than Argue. But throughout our research for this episode, we realized that debates have strict rules that all parties agree to. But that's not exactly what it's like when a casual conversation at the dinner table turns into a yelling match. That's why, instead, we're calling this episode Emotions in Politics. This episode will guide you through the best ways to have these conversations. In this time between season 1 and season 2, I invite you to have a forum, discussion, conversation, whatever you want to call it, with family or friends about one of the topics from the past season. And we'd love to hear how it goes. You can email us a voicemail about your experience at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com or tag us on Instagram at sitstill_lookopinionated and use the hashtag SSLODiscussions. And who knows, maybe we'll feature it on a future episode. Then as always, today's episode will include a rundown of this week's top news stories. If there was ever an episode to enjoy a margarita with the show, it's right now. So grab your marg, take a deep breath, and let's get started. Today, we're going to learn about how to talk about politics without getting caught up in emotion. As we say almost every week, this podcast is about educating yourself so that you'll feel confident holding a conversation about these topics in your own right. The way I view it, we've supplied you with the what, but now we want to supply you with the how. Because when you get down to it, politics is emotional. That's why the taboo around it exists. However, without the continued discussion with others who disagree with us, we will only continue to reinforce our own beliefs and demonize the beliefs of others. So, let's talk about how to talk about politics. Let me just start by saying that politics are extremely personal to everyone. So something that you deeply believe in could very well be offensive to someone else. With that being said, I would recommend that when you go into a discussion about politics, that you state your intentions. If there are guidelines set about what each party wishes to discuss, then you can identify when you get to the parts of the conversation that you know are going to cross your boundaries, and vice versa. A website called mynomadiccompass.com put it like this. By mutually discussing what you want to achieve from the discussion, you'll know how to approach it better when discussing your point of views. And honestly, I can't think of a better way to put it. Now, when it comes to politics, the number one thing you should think about is try not to educate. Think about it. When you're in a conversation, you don't like to be educated. It feels like the other person is saying that they know more than you and they're talking down to you because of it. No one is going to change their minds unless they want to change their minds. Like you're listening to this podcast because you wanted to, or because you're one of my friends and family who I guilt-tripped into it. The second thing you should consider when undertaking these discussions is to go into it with an open mind. Don't go in there prejudging someone. Go in there and actually plan on listening to their argument. A CIA agent named Amaryllis Fox explained it like this. Everyone thinks they're the good guy. If you go in there thinking that what they think is already wrong, then you're essentially saying that they aren't the good guy. Imagine if that happened to you. Fuck them, right? You don't have to agree with what they believe. Just understand where they're coming from. Remember, empathy does not equal endorsement. Another important aspect is to always show respect. What do I mean by this? For starters, let them get their point across. Try not to interrupt them. Take turns sharing an equal amount of time expressing one another's point of views. And try to find a common ground. And stick it out. I know I always feel disrespected when I'm in the middle of an argument, and rather than hear my point of view on something, the person I'm arguing with tries to just bail on the conversation. Stick through the uncomfortable parts. Sticking through the uncomfortable parts is another way of showing respect for the other person's point of view. It's also the way you grow as a person. What's that saying? No pain, no gain? The pain you feel today is the strength you gain tomorrow? What doesn't kill you makes you more tolerable to other people's point of view? Something like that. The most important thing to keep in mind is that you both try to search for understanding. You remain respectful in your tone and your actions, and be thankful to the other person for sharing their point of view and showing you the same level of courtesy. Take these steps with family and friends who you disagree with, and you'll be on your way to easier conversations about politics. However, everything I just talked about are the steps you would want to take if you're talking to someone who actually wants to find something in common. Sometimes you encounter people who just want to find the higher ground so they can talk down to you. This is called arguing in bad faith. These people have no interest in what your side of the argument is. They know they're 100% right and that you're an idiot for not seeing just how wrong you are. A website called psychcentral.com describes extremes as dedicated to deliberately misunderstanding and mischaracterizing others, often to the point of absurdity. They are willingly dishonest, deceptive, and morally corrupt, often while at the same time quick to accuse others of being dishonest, deceptive, and morally corrupt. Those are the extremes that the media and the echo chambers like to focus on. The boogeyman of the opposing point of view. And if one of them is like this, then all of them are. As I've discovered firsthand, I know this is not true. But if you ever find yourself in a conversation with someone displaying these qualities, let's break down how to identify someone as arguing in bad faith, and how to handle yourself in those situations as well. Here are the qualities to look for. According to that same website, a bad faith arguer will engage in provoking, bullying, and intimidation, ranging from personal attacks to threats of physical aggression. They will deflect, attack, and project to throw you off your train of thought. That is because their goal in the conversation is not to relate to a fellow human being, but to win the conversation. When challenged, they'll be quick to jump into attack mode. Because of this, they'll engage in tactics such as lying, denying, and changing the definition of terms to better suit their position, even sometimes to the point of denial or delusion. By the way, if someone lies to the point of making someone else question their reality, that's called gaslighting, and it can be subtle. Look for phrases like, "I didn't yell at you, I was just passionate," or, "This is not abusive or manipulative, I was just being assertive and honest." So how do you handle it? Don't use accusatory language or try to blame their way of thinking. They already see themselves as the hero, just like everyone else. But these people are never in the wrong. And you, the enemy, are not going to change their minds. Try to empathize with their emotions behind their words. I see that X makes you angry, and I can relate to that feeling. The type of person who we are categorizing is usually looking for a fight. And if you deny them that conflict, it will throw them off their game. Use we language. In this scenario, people tend to look at it as a you versus me situation. But by continuously using we, you are putting the thought in their mind that we are in this together. Don't expect an apology or a concession. Change doesn't happen overnight, and people who live their life by being right are not going to admit they're wrong. And finally, don't take the bait. Sometimes you can't help but walk into it, but if you're able to see that this is the type of person who won't listen to different points of view, then mentally arm yourself not to dive into a shouting match rather than a conversation. So what's the big deal? Why do I have to go out of my comfort zone to confront people whose views are so backwards? Wouldn't it be easier to just unfriend my Trump-supporting and cop-endorsing cousin? Yeah, that would be easier. But remember what a famous wizard once said. You have to make the choice between what is right and what is easy. By talking with your family and friends about these issues, you create a space for understanding and empathy, both of which are vital to help us grow as a society. Now, I'm not saying this is a fail-safe method. Some people are just downright hateful, and if you need to delete someone for your own mental health or physical safety, by all means, be my guest. But maybe cool it on the unfollow spree just because your roommate from college hasn't posted every single day about the protests they're attending. If you really want to know how someone is practicing good allyship, just shoot them a quick text and ask. Like I said at the top of the show, if you need support in these conversations, let this podcast help you. Use these episodes as a starting point and do your own research and find what works for you. Then have the conversations and grow as you go. We can't wait to hear about your experiences, so make sure you email us. next, this week's headlines. Monday, President Trump delivered a huge blow to the tech industry when he signed an executive order that temporarily suspended many non-immigrant visas. Although, not like this matters, because Silicon Valley will still probably vote for him anyway. Last week, the Supreme Court upheld the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, and denied the Trump administration's defunding of the program because of inadequate justification. Which is a nice way of telling Trump, just because you don't like someone doesn't mean they can't live the American dream, sweetie. In NASCAR news, last week a noose was found in the Talladega Super Speedway garage of Bubba Wallace, the only black race car driver in the league. The FBI did a swift investigation into the incident, and in a recent statement said that the noose was only part of the garage door and not part of a hate crime. Seems like the only gas I smell at this racetrack is gaslighting. In recent weeks, statues and paintings of prominent slave owners and Confederate generals have been taken down across the country and moved into permanent storage. I'd say this is the perfect setup for a remake of Night at the Museum, but according to my sources, no one is interested in bringing Columbus back to life. Last weekend, Trump made headlines when his rally in Tulsa managed to sell only 6,000 seats in a 19,000-seat stadium. Of course, I'm sure this isn't the first time Trump has heard the phrase, smaller than expected, when asked to perform. The EU considered barring travel from Americans due to the poor response to the coronavirus outbreak, proving to the right-wing extremists that the rest of the world is part of a democratic hoax. Piggybacking off of that, coronavirus cases have begun to hit record highs in states like Florida, Texas, and Arizona. With its resurgence, COVID-19 has decided to put its name on the primary ballots. When asked for a quote, COVID said that it thought its chances were good because the people in these states don't seem to be in any rush to get rid of me. And that's this week's headlines. Today's interview is a little different than our past episodes. It's more of a conversation. As you all know, I've been challenging you to sit down and have these topical conversations. And I knew it was about time I start putting my money where my mouth is. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with friend of the podcast, Mallory Murphy Harris. We may not see eye to eye on everything, but we had a great conversation nonetheless. Stay tuned. Today on the show, we have Mallory Harris. She is a friend of our producer, Mike, and I'm super excited to have a conversation. Mallory, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself for our listeners?
Sure. Hi, I'm Mallory. I am 29 years old. I am married to an excellent man and husband named Matt. And we live in a smaller town just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. We've been married for almost 6 years, and he is a student pastor at a Baptist church here. We have 3 children. We have a 5-year-old daughter, a 3-year-old daughter, and a 5-month-old son. And I'm a stay-at-home mom. I stay home with them, and I partner in ministry with Matt. So I spend a lot of time with high school students. So we have a pretty fun life.
Yeah, that sounds like you've got a nice big family. A little bit about me. My birthday is this weekend, so I'm about to be 25. I live in Chicago, and I'm originally from the East Coast. This is our season one finale of the podcast. Mike and I have been working on this project for about 3 months or so. From what Mike has told me about you, we might have some different beliefs, but the whole point of this podcast is to converse with people and just talk about views and have like a open conversation. So my first question is, do you identify with like a certain political party, or are you more just in like values versus party?
Well, I definitely would say values over party. I am registered Republican. Generally, you know, more conservative in my views. I just don't always, I have written in a third party candidate before. So yeah, I would say that I generally fall under the Republican.
Cool. And for our listeners, I am definitely more of a liberal. I have voted Democratic in the past, back in 2016 and in Chicago as well. Have you always been a Republican? Is it been something like it was your family, or did you like find that more in college?
I grew up more traditional, more conservative evangelical, and then maintained those views even in college. And I was a theater student, which is generally at a huge university, which is funny. You know, Mike and I have lots of great conversations. And it's really funny because I love to discuss religion and politics as well. And Mike used to always tell me, I don't want to discuss religion or politics. So it cracks me up that he has a political podcast. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also am Christian. I was raised Episcopalian, and I go to a Lutheran church here in Chicago. But yeah, and I feel like it was always super taboo, like, growing up, even though I also went to a theater school, and it was, like, people always were talking about their views. But I was like, oh, I don't really, like, I don't want to cause any problems. But I think I'm realizing that, like, you can still chat and not, like, cause problems. Have you had any experiences like that where you've expressed a view and then someone has like responded in a way that you didn't even intend to have that conversation?
That's a good question. Yes, I would say that's happened a couple of times. I remember one time in college, I was discussing with two other women, we were discussing the abortion issue, which is a heavy issue. Mm-hmm. And I understand not everyone wanting to dialogue about it on a regular basis. But they, I think, kind of assumed that I agreed with their viewpoint. And so they were, you know, espousing pro-choice beliefs. And I kind of interjected and gave a pro-life perspective. And I think it scared them. Because they just, like, they didn't really want to continue the conversation. And they kind of shut it down. And I was like, okay. I definitely didn't want to make anybody comfortable. But like you said, I definitely think that there's a way to be able to discuss those things and it not have to be so awkward.
Yeah. Yeah. Because especially like, I mean, we're pretty close in age, even though our lives seem to be a little different, but there's no reason that you can't like talk about things like abortion, or, you know, other things that are going on. In that same vein, like, what are your thoughts on abortion? Like, what are your views on it? And why do you feel that way?
Yeah, so abortion is an issue that's really close to my heart. I think that I feel like science has kind of confirmed, to be honest, that life begins, you know, at conception with a heartbeat, and that to intercede and to end that life is ending a life. And so I feel like constitutionally, even the unborn child is, you know, given a right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And I think it's a little bit, I just think it's interesting that, you know, it can be a crime to take an eagle egg that's unborn and has a fetus of an eagle. It would be illegal to harm that. But then when it comes to an unborn child, it's okay to intervene and end the child's life. I feel like the argument that, you know, women should be able to do what they, you know, what they want with their body. In my opinion, there are lots of things that we can't do with our body if it means hurting somebody. You know, we can't get in a fight. We can't murder. And so there are things that already we're limited. And we can't even walk around naked. I mean, there are just things that by law the government has said you can't do this with your body. And so for those reasons, I've always been pro-life.
Yeah.
From a biblical standpoint, I think that the Bible shows that God values even the unborn child.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think?
On the flip side, from my point of view, I feel that, you know,
I would prefer to have a choice to maybe if a child, if I was raped, if I was ever like forcefully put into a situation where I didn't want to have a child, I didn't want to bring that life in because I wouldn't be able to support them, or I know the system around me wouldn't be able to support them. Now, this is all speaking hypotheticals. Like, I have a loving family that I know would help me, but I am just imagining all of these other people out in the world who, you know, maybe they really don't have the financial stability, and they know that if they did give birth to a child, they would just go into a system where it would perpetuate, you know, maybe they would grow up not having a family that loved and supported them. So it might be easier for the mother to say, you know, this is not what I want. I'm not ready for this. And instead of pushing them into something they're not ready for, having a choice to say, you know, this is my body, and right now I want to take control of my life. I think it's a little bit just a different point of view in being able to say, I'm not ready for this. I don't want this. Or this was a harmful memory, and I don't want to have a harmful memory in my life all the time. And then I also think of, you know, like childbirth and the health of a baby, and if the birth of that child is going to harm the mother, like if I was in that situation, like as crude as this might sound, like I could have another baby, but I can't have another life. So I think in that point of view, in like a medical stance, I think there could be a way that it could be helpful to save a life in that sense. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I think that, you know, I think there are certain instances in a tubal pregnancy when, or something like that, when the mother's life is at stake, that the, you know, there comes some ambiguity with what would maybe be the ethical choice. As far as a person who is raped or who has an unwanted pregnancy and you know, feels I don't have the capacity to take care of a child, or I feel like adoption should be the first and primary option. And the sad thing is that adoption is so expensive today, and I wish it weren't that way. I have my sister-in-law, her sister and brother-in-law stand outside of Planned Parenthood every week, and they have for years. And they're not hateful. They're very kind. But basically, they say, we will adopt your baby. If you go in there and find out you're pregnant and you don't want your child, we will take on the burden. We will pay for things. We will walk with you through it. We will be an emotional support. And actually, just last week, a woman, it's been years, but just last week, a woman came out and said, you know, I was raped. And I'm pregnant, and I don't want anything to do with the child. And she said, I don't want to take care of it. I don't want to see it. You know, there's a lot of emotional things that it will bring up to carry this child. But at the same time, like, I feel a need to preserve this life, and I want this child to have a chance. And so this child is going to be, you know, adopted by this family. I think about it 15 years from now, 10 years from now, you know, this child is going to be in a loving family and alive and able to experience life because this mother made this unselfish decision. And I just wish that happened more, that mothers felt supported by their local communities so that they would feel like, I can do this. I can give this child life, even if it's not me that sustains this life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think adoption is a great, great thing. My nephews are both adopted from China. But I think the thing that sticks out to me the most is that, like, that isn't available to everyone. And not everyone has a family who sees them about to go in and says, hey, I'll be there for you. Like, I think that's phenomenal that your sister and brother-in-law or your family is able to do that. But when I think about it, I'm like, oh, well, In a bigger picture, in my point of view, it doesn't seem like that's always going to happen. Like, I know here in Chicago, there's a Planned Parenthood that's right in the middle of downtown, and people are in there all the time, but no one's outside saying, like, hey, I'll give you a hand. But I can agree with you that, like, I do think the community and that people should be there to support other people. Like, that would be phenomenal. If that were the case, like, without a doubt, I would say, yeah, like, I would want to have a baby. But I think I also just want to give, in the same vein that America is all about choice, like, I have the ability to decide, you know, what I believe in, where I stand. I feel like I should have the choice as well to say, like, hey, this isn't something I want. And it might be a little bit more on the selfish side, but ultimately, like, this is my life, and I don't want to bring another person into it if I don't know that they're going to have the best life. Do you have any other thoughts on that, or anything else you want to, like, any other points you want to touch on?
I think when it comes to the abortion issue, it's really a fight between two values.
Mm-hmm.
The value of me having ease and comfort versus a child being given the right to live. And so I just feel like those, for me, it's just very clear that the mother who, you know, is carrying this child should make a choice for life and put her own ease on the back burner. But I know it's a hard issue, but I also feel like just the life beginning at conception is black and white. I don't know the statistics on this, but I think if you have had one abortion, it is more likely that you will get another.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes me wary that sometimes it's used as forms of birth control. You know, the number one reason why people get an abortion worldwide is gender. So they, you know, they get pregnant with a girl and, you know, don't want to have a girl because they, you know, have limited means and only want to bring one child into the world and would prefer a male child. And so I think all of those things may be taken into account as well.
Yeah. I think for me, from what I know about sexual health, is I think conception is, or not conception, contraception is very important. If that is something you want to do, if you aren't ready to have a child, you know, use, like, proper protection, use a condom, take the birth control pill.
Yeah.
And I think that is where it really should be. So, I mean, I'm all about, you know, sexual education and learning about what your options are so that it's not your last resort. Do you have a thought about that too?
Yeah, I think that a lot of times in cases like Planned Parenthood, they have a financial incentive to push abortion. And a lot of times when women are in a vulnerable and emotional state and they're young and, you know, they're faced with this, you know, with this major life change, I think a lot of times that the doctors at Planned Parenthood are financially motivated to say, hey, you know, you don't have to do this. You know, you have this option for abortion, and they leave Planned Parenthood with, you know, a lot of times physical trauma, emotional and psychological trauma, and they have to pay a lot of money. And so I feel like sometimes they aren't given the option of being given, you know, good resources or someone who says, hey, like there are places that help you carry this on. Like, you can get mental health from these Christian organizations, or there are families that would love to adopt your baby. I feel like they're really getting one perspective.
Have you ever been in a Planned Parenthood or, like, seen what they're like on the inside?
I mean, I've seen videos and heard testimonies. I personally have not gone inside.
Mm-hmm. From my personal experience, I go to Planned Parenthood for all of my health care. They're my primary physician. They're my OBGYN, just because, you know, I live in Chicago on my own. I don't have my whole family there. And,
right,
like, from my experience, I've never felt pressure. I mean, I haven't gone in there saying I'm pregnant and I am looking for an option, but I've always felt very, like, supported there. So I'm not quite sure what those statistics are either, like, where the money really lies. But from my experience, right, Planned Parenthood is, like, a lot more than just, you know, taking people and, like, pregnant women and doing other things. Like, it's also a full facility where, you know, I got tested for an STI, and they even told me, like, you can bring your boyfriend in and we can test him too. Like, it's not just for women, but that's just my experience from my point of view. Yeah. How has COVID been for your family? How's all that been?
It's been interesting. I think that we have had some good experiences and, you know, some hard experiences. I think that some of the good things are it forces to slow way down and adapt a slower lifestyle. I felt like we were going, you know, just full speed ahead to just, you know, activities and school and things like that. So a nice thing has been, you know, more family time and being home. I really enjoyed this season, this age of my kids. It's been really nice to just spend time outside and be together. I think that some of the hard parts is, you know, not being able to gather. I've, you know, we really miss gathering with our church and gathering with groups of friends. So that was hard spiritually and emotionally. But overall, I would say that I've learned from it. So that was good. What about you?
Yeah, it's been, so I'm an actor and a performer, and I actually had a lot of shows canceled during the season, which has been really tough, just like emotionally, just kind of seeing like I had shows planned from April through the end of the summer, and then plans for shows in the fall, and so that's been really tough, just kind of seeing that decline. But I'm really thankful that, you know, I have a safe place to stay and, you know, my family's all safe. But yeah, I definitely agree with the slowing down, because I was, you know, go, 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 working all the time and very active. But yeah, it's definitely been like a real wake up call to my life, just to say, like, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, how are you, how have you been processing, you know, the race issue and, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a lot. So, Chicago has been like a huge hub for all of it. And, you know, it's really made me think about where I've messed up in the past. My boyfriend is Indian, and so he's not white, and we've been having a lot of conversations about that and about what our relationship means. But I think at the center of it, I've been putting myself first when it's not really about me. Like, this is not my movement. It's for me to understand someone, but like really just realizing that like we are all people. Like, we're all human. We all, like, you know, George Floyd had a daughter and he had a family, and like I couldn't even imagine what that would be like if one day my dad went to the store and came and like then never came back. So it's definitely been scary, but I'm like, I don't have any reason to be scared. Like, I need to be better about realizing that like I have a privilege, and that's why I do this podcast too, is because I'm like, I have a platform to say what's going on, and use it to help others realize that too, that like, you know, white privilege doesn't mean my life hasn't been hard. It just means that when I go to the grocery store, no one's going to assume I'm trying to steal anything. And then just, you know, I want to have kids one day too. And, I don't know, you know, if my boyfriend and I will get married, who knows, like we're only a few years in, but like, if we have kids, like, they're going to be mixed race, and that's going to be, like, something I never thought about before I even met him. So I'm not sure, you know, where our future will go, but it's definitely just made me realize, like, if I'm going to bring someone into this world who doesn't look like me, like, how can I equip myself to be a better person for them? How have you felt about everything?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's been an emotional couple of weeks. But at the same time, also very good, very eye-opening. Kind of like you, I feel like it's not my movement. And a lot of white people have asked, you know, what can I do? And I think that's good, but I think it's clear kind of what we need to do. And it's more than just, you know, posting on Facebook, you know, I'm an anti-racist ally. It involves, like, actively, you know, making a difference, making changes in your own life and in your community and in your home. You know, my kids aren't mixed race, they're white, but it really matters to me to raise them in such a way that they're very comfortable with diversity. And not just comfortable with it, but that they rejoice in diversity. And so it's been good. It's brought about good conversations in our house.
Good.
Yeah. So it's been good. It's been good. It's been also also, I think, excellent for, you know, my relationships with my friends that are Black American or Indian, and to kind of ask what their experiences have been, and it has been eye-opening in a lot of ways to what things that they've experienced. I got off of social media because I was just seeing all of those stories of people experiencing racism in their lives. It's just disheartening.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. How have you talked about this with your kids? Like, how do they know about what's going on? Like, what's that kind of been like?
Yeah, so our kids are pretty young. I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 5-month-old. So we've talked about it a little bit with our 5- and 3-year-old, and it's been good. You know, I had heard my kids talking about race even before this had happened. They were coloring, and like their Crayola crayons, and they were using different colors to do skin color, and they were just really into coloring people that all looked different. And I overheard them in the car one day coming home from preschool. Nora is my oldest daughter, and she said to Anne-Marie, does Gabriel in your class have brown skin? And Anne-Marie said, no, it's apricot. It just made me laugh because apricot is the name of the Crayola color that they use for white people. And so they talk about it in such a frank way, but it was heartbreaking to have to sit Nora down a week or so ago and say, you know, she said something like, why is mommy crying? I was, you know, crying about something I read on Facebook. And my husband was like, well, she's crying because sometimes people are treated differently because of their skin color. And she was like, you know, she was just very confused and concerned, and she said, my skin color? And, you know, it was hard to be like, no, not your skin color. You know, you won't have to think about your skin color as you grow up, but other people will. So that was kind of hard. But I've been looking at different resources and books too, kids' books that we can use to kind of teach our kids know about diversity. And it, you know, I think it's important too, just to make sure that they have friends that are diverse, and that you have friends that, you know, come from different, you know, beliefs, you know, different cultures.
Yeah, I totally agree, because I think that's the only way you grow and expand your mindset, is to, like, learn about other cultures and other people and other people's walks of life, because ultimately, like, if you spend your whole life in one way, like, that's, I think, what fosters people to not understand and not understand why people are different. Yeah. I think that's really amazing that you guys actually talked to your daughter about it, because, like, I mean, I always knew race was a thing, but growing up, it was never, like, discussed with me why, or, like, I just was kind of like, oh, this is just a thing. And then, like, in my adult life, I've had to unlearn and read and really, like, examine biases that I grew up with that I didn't even know. They were just part of my education and, like, part of life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It is. It's hard. In high school, I think I just was kind of under the assumption that racism wasn't a thing anymore. Until I was in high school, and a boy on my brother's basketball team was from Haiti. He came and lived with us for 5 years. And when Davidson started living with us, I mean, it was like, you could see immediately how differently he was treated compared to my brother when they would go out together in public. And it was so, I think that's when my empathy really started, because Davidson got to a point where he wouldn't even bat an eyelash. It was like he was so used to being treated differently. And I mean, man, it was heartbreaking to see.
Yeah. What was that like, having someone in your home? Like, what was that experience like?
It was good. It was a lot of time when I was at college. So I think he was there for a little while, and then I moved to college. So he was there when I went home. But it was always good. It was always funny. It was always an adventure. I remember him telling my parents that he hoped one day he would marry a girl just like Ellen. She's generous. He just loved Ellen. And I mean, he's an awesome person. He's still, you know, part of the family. You know, he doesn't live in my family anymore. He's an adult now. But it was good. It was eye-opening. I'm really thankful. I'm really thankful for him.
That's amazing. Well, Mallory, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm really glad that I could bring you on, and I hope that we can talk again in the future.
I know. It was really nice to meet you, Claire.
Nice to meet you too, Mallory. That's our show today. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at sitstill_lookopinionated. And now on Twitter at sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. Thanks for an amazing first season. Stay tuned for all the exciting things we have in store for season 2. Follow us on all the socials for all the podcast news and updates. Have a great, opinionated few weeks. Bye!